Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We are going to roll to our first really cool story, and that one is about the world's first drug that actually sends stem cells where they need to go. One of the problems we've had with stem cells is that, well, you know, you inject them into the bloodstream and they kind of don't automatically, magically head off to the area that you're directing them to. And so finding a way to label the desired location for the stem cells to kind of home in on has been a problem. Now, that's been solved by people injecting stem cells directly into the areas and with variable results. Probably a lot of the stem cell therapy that you read about in the back of the airport airline in-flight magazine isn't going to work or doesn't work, and those photos are bogus. I swear to God, they're bogus. So, that being said, researchers at Sanford Burnham Presbyterian Medical Discovery Institute just published a really interesting article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So what they're doing is really cool. What they're doing is they're using an inflammatory marker, which they already had an idea about, and playing around with it. So let's talk about the stem cell. I'm going to quote the lead researcher, Evan Snyder. "The ability to instruct a stem cell where to go in the body or to a particular region of a given organ is the holy grail for regenerative medicine." He is the professor and director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center, which we've already described. "Now, for the first time ever, we can direct a stem cell to a desired location and focus its therapeutic impact." Snyder's been working on stem cells for a while, and over 15 years ago, he discovered with his team that stem cells are drawn to inflammation. We all know more about inflammation in 2020 than we knew about it in 2019. It's the biological fire alarm that signals damage has occurred and activates the immune system. However, using inflammation as a lure to try to heal hasn't worked, because if you create an inflammatory environment, hello, that causes damage. So researchers have been trying to find a way to create a homing device, and this would be, oh God, helpful for everything. We could use it in spinal cord injury. We could use it in other types of old chronic injury like stroke, because the inflammation fades over time. And maybe we could use it even in heart disease, although honestly, it might make that worse. So I'm now going to tell you that the funding for this came from Your Tax Dollars at Work, California, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, which is funding stem cell research because we were smart enough to fund independent stem cell research here in the state of California, because we wanted to continue doing it despite the Bush administration's. Remember the Bush administration? Well, one of the things they did was cut the funding from this. And so it's extremely good that we kept funding it, because this could be a real game changer. So what they did was they modified a inflammatory molecule called CXCL12. And this is something Snyder's team had previously identified as being able to guide the healing stem cells to the sites in need of repair. And what they did was they doctored it, they played with the molecule, and they enhanced the stem cell binding, but they minimized the inflammatory signaling. So they got rid of that cytokine storm, but they still could call the stem cells. So it was like a more directed signal. Other cool thing about this is it's pretty non-toxic, and it can be injected anywhere into the body to lure those stem cells to a specific location. So they maximized the good and, you know, got rid of most of the negative. Then they had to prove it. So they implanted the brains of human nerve cells in culture, and they implanted those human nerve cells into the brains of mice with a neurodegenerative disease. And they also put the SDV1A in there. And what happened was that the human stem cells went straight to the areas of damage. And they also got some really interesting effects in the mice, including extending their lifespan and preserving motor function for much longer than the mice that didn't receive this drug. Plus, they didn't activate inflammation. So here we're looking at stem cell therapy in a mouse model of ALS. That's Lou Gehrig's disease. That causes a loss of motor neurons in the brain and is probably the most horrible disease you can think of, because you become paralyzed, but you feel everything. And eventually, even your ability to breathe can become paralyzed. It's a horrific illness. And it's wonderful that there's a ray of hope for this, because I personally have been involved with several ALS patients, and so many things have been tried. I don't think I've ever heard of anything quite this promising. So stay tuned. It might be very, very good news, and it's in the future, but I thought maybe a little optimism is called for, especially in the last few weeks, although we have had some optimistic word on vaccines. I've been swatting up, as they say in England, on vaccines and their differences and the variations and the challenges that they create when we actually try to administer them to, well, effectively the population of the planet. But let's leave that for another time and move on to something that's perfectly topical for Thanksgiving Eve, and that's the miracle drug called chocolate. More specifically, cocoa flavonoids, which are a compound found in most plants. They give it color. They're antioxidants. And it's already been demonstrated that eating foods rich in flavonoids can benefit vascular function. But this is a really interesting study, and chocolate can make you smarter, at least if it's good cocoa with lots of bioflavonoids. So the researchers looked at adult non-smokers with no known brain, heart, vascular, respiratory disease, because they wanted to see if this population could benefit their brain function. They tested 18 participants before their intake of these cocoa flavonoids, and in two separate trials, one the subjects received flavonoid-rich cocoa, and another which they consumed processed cocoa with very low levels of flavonoids. So neither the participants or the researchers knew which type of cocoa, so that made it a double-blind placebo study, so no expectation bias. And here's how they set it up. 2 hours after consuming the cocoa, the participants breathed in air, which was 5% carbon dioxide, which is about 100 times the normal concentration. And it's a standard method for challenging the brain vasculature. The brain and the body typically respond by increasing blood flow to the brain, which brings in more oxygen and allows the brain to eliminate carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is often a vasodilator. So they used a technique called functional near-infrared spectroscopy, which we actually talked about last week. It's a new technique being used in brain research that uses light to capture changes in blood flow to the brain. They can actually see through your skull and detail where the blood is going. So they looked at oxygenation in the frontal cortex, a brain region that plays a key role in planning, regulating behavior and decision-making, also problem-solving. So they wanted to see how well the brain defended itself against excess carbon dioxide, and the answers were really well. I'll give you a spoiler alert. But they also challenged the participants with complex tasks that required them to do two things at once. Sort of the chew gum and tap your tummy or something, you know, it's hard to do two things at once. And that's what they wanted to see how their functioning was. So that they first impaired the brain, then they saw whether or not they got benefit. And boy, did they. Most of the participants had a stronger and faster brain oxygen response after exposure to the cocoa flavonoids. They were faster than they were at baseline, in other words, before they even got the CO2. And, of course, the cocoa without the flavonoids didn't do anything. The maximal oxygenation was three times higher in the high flavanol cocoa group. And the oxygenation response was about 1 minute faster. They also performed better on the most challenging cognitive tests, solving problems 11% faster than they did at baseline. And so that's a really, really substantial benefit. They didn't actually get better on easy tasks, however. So only those cognitive tasks that were more challenging, the ones that required more brain cells and more rapid processing, and therefore more oxygen. But there were four of the 18 subjects who didn't get better with the flavonoids, and these were the people who already had the best oxygen response at baseline. So essentially, any room for improvement. They were already so good. We'll need to study that group further to find out what they were eating and see whether or not it was all about exercise, physical fitness, heredity, or what other factors caused these outliers to be outliers. Still, a wonderful reason to get some flavanol-rich cocoa the next time you have a complex task, maybe an examination, other things that require lots and lots of cognitive activity. And so my good luck to you, and you are hereby encouraged to eat chocolate. And, you know, how bad is that? So also moving in a little bit of the longevity mood and how to live longer and be smarter, we get to an interesting study in hyperbaric oxygen treatment. So there are a lot of processes that we can measure in aging cells. And we can look at the chromosomes, we can look at the telomeres, which are the protective caps located on both ends of every chromosome, sometimes referred to as the shoelace cap that one puts on a shoelace so it doesn't unravel. Obviously, you don't want your DNA unraveling. And these shoelace caps shorten with age. For a long time, it was thought to be an inevitable and irreversible process and part of a biological clock. But like most things we think we know in science, we later have to revise our knowledge. And now it turns out that telomeres can grow back. And the other thing that was measured in this study was the accumulation of old and malfunctioning cells, something called senescent cells, which you can tell by looking at them in a blood specimen. So the study focused on immune cells containing DNA from the participants' blood. And what they discovered was a lengthening of up to 38% of the telomeres and a decrease of 37% in the presence of senescent cells. So this blows all of the other longevity things that we've talked about on this show over the years. It blows high-intensity intermittent exercise. It blows fasting, intermittent fasting, fasting-mimicking diet. All of these things do lengthen telomeres and help get rid of senescent cells, but not at a level of more than a third. I mean, that's super good. The study that we're talking about was in 64-year-old or older people, 35 of them, and they had 60 hyperbaric sessions over a period of 90 days. Now, that's a lot of hyperbaric sessions, and each participant provided blood samples before, during, and at the end of treatments, and they took a look at the things we've talked about, the parameters I've mentioned. And the treatments actually reversed the aging process, made the blood younger, and made the telomeres longer at a rate of between 20 to 38% for the different cell types tested, and 11 to 37% of the senescent cells, again, depending on what you were testing. So this was 3 months of hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and it's very promising. Now, there's a few little devils in the details, and one of those is that hyperbaric oxygen is expensive, and this study was at 2 atmospheres for 90 minutes. And you can find the article, but essentially not available to you right now unless you're very rich, because the hyperbaric oxygen chambers that are often seen in chiropractic offices or naturopathic offices will get you up to 1.3 atmospheres, but they won't get you up to 2 atmospheres. For that, you need a metal box. Also, it was a pretty complicated pattern. They decompressed people at 1 meter squared a minute. They took air breaks every 20 minutes. You were going to need somebody on the controls to duplicate this. Maybe this complex process isn't necessary. It's the beginning of something interesting. But I don't know if you remember that Michael Jackson reportedly slept in a hyperbaric oxygen chamber. That was from some interview that I read many, many years ago. And I'm sure he was doing it for anti-aging, and it probably helped his skin, but it probably wasn't enough to get into the brain or really raise the blood oxygen to the level that was seen in this study. However, he may have been on the right track, and who knows? Let's start with our first email. This from, it looks like TSI in Stone Mountain. I'm not sure if that's Stone Mountain, Georgia, or another Stone Mountain, but hi there, Ty. And he wrote, difficulty swallowing. Hello, I have difficulty swallowing when I eat. Food gets stuck in the middle, under the neck, and upper chest. What is this problem, and what can I do about it? So, Ty, I'll start with saying that there are a lot of possibilities here, and some of them are medically important. So it's important to think about this from the standpoint of, is this every time you eat? And also, how is it when you swallow water? So the absolute worst answer would be, it's worse when I swallow liquids, and that sometimes the liquids or the food come out my nose. And that would be very urgent. So without going into details, if anything's coming out of your nose, you are going to have to brave whatever barriers stand in the way of seeing an ear, nose, and throat doctor and go in and see an ear, nose, and throat doctor so they can take a look at you. The other reason you just see an ear, nose, and throat doctor would be if you always feel like there's something, and if you're starting to choke on things like your own saliva, because in those circumstances they have to get a look at you back there. If there's hoarseness, particularly if the hoarseness is getting worse, that is another reason to see an ENT, but I think you would have mentioned that. So we'll start with what could be going on here that's doesn't require an immediate doctor's visit that you might be able to attempt managing at home. And I need to emphasize, any advice I give out here is for educational purposes. If I tell you need to see a doctor to get this solved, you need to see a doctor to get this solved. And so you shouldn't mistake this for a medical visit, because there's just no way that I have enough information to give medical advice, particularly in this situation, because you're a man of few words or a woman of few words. We see a lot of esophageal spasm. I've seen more esophageal spasm in the last year than I think I've seen in the last decade. And part of the reason is because when people are very stressed and they're not sleeping well and they have a lot of concerns, there's a phenomenon in their nervous system that in Chinese medicine, they call it plum pit qi, which it feels like you've swallowed a plum pit. And it doesn't, and it won't go down. And this can happen. This happens kind of chronically, and people walk around with this feeling. And then when they do eat, they get this spasm. It's relieved by Chinese medicine herbs. And so, if it works, if the Chinese medicine herbs for plum pit qi are helpful, or the acupuncture treatments for this, you can relax about getting your anatomy checked, because we have evidence that you're dealing with something that's neurological and benign, okay? there are all sorts of things that can cause things to get stuck in your throat. You could have, for example, enlarged material behind your thyroid, like a thyroid cyst that's kind of pressing on the area. You could have what's called an esophageal web, or some other structure that's squeezing the esophagus so that things are narrower. And in the setting of an esophageal web or a physical structure, you'll often find that you don't have any problems with pureed food. Another thing that can cause this sensation is an irritable esophagus, and that can happen from heartburn. It can happen from food sensitivity. It just can happen from eating too much and then lying down right away. So usually people will have had that symptom for a while before they develop this. But overall, this is a problem that if it's been persistent and it's not just a short-term thing, you're really going to need to get it checked out structurally, because there are too many structural issues that can manifest this way. One thing that many primary care doctors suggest is just a trial of a proton pump inhibitor. I'm not a fan of proton pump inhibitors, which turn off your stomach acid, but I'm also not a rigid person. So if you use that for a week and you get better, that would indicate that maybe you just have too much stomach acid. I hope that's been helpful, and I hope that we'll hear from you again. So now we have a follow-up email from Victoria in Indianapolis. She had sent a message last week, which I believe we covered last week, about a squeaking kind of noise when she breathed that she was thinking of as wheezing. But when I explained to her that wheezing is only loud when you breathe out, usually asthmatics are quite quiet, at least to the naked ear, when they breathe in, and it doesn't change with cough, this problem of hers, then we would call it stridor, which is something that little kids with RSV and certain whooping cough, for example, will get. And the whoop is when they breathe in. She goes on, yes, the trip to the pulmonologist was for a chest CT, nothing worrisome, but a follow-up in 6 months just to be sure. The ENT ordered a thyroid ultrasound based on my history, my lumpy thyroid, and a small amount of the thyroid image the CT caught. Her exam found minor swelling of my vocal cords, but no redness. They didn't think it was GERD, heartburn, because of that, and the findings were not showing worsening, and so she's doing well. They put her on some Flonase for the nasal swelling that they saw, and some proton pump inhibitors, and they're going to recheck that in a little while. I also want to point out, Victoria, that presumably the ENT did listen to your chest, and that this wasn't a visit occurring over the telephone, because unfortunately, under COVID, we're having a lot of difficulty with people not getting listened to because you can't listen to a chest remotely. I would see someday, maybe in the future, that you'll be, when you sign up for a health plan, they'll send you a kit, including something that you can put on your chest and hook into your phone that will broadcast the sounds of your chest to the doctor. And lately, with all the telemedicine I'm doing, I've been kind of wishing they would hurry up and get those devices released. But this kind of caught everyone by surprise, and we're doing the best we can. I hope that you get better. And if you don't, please don't ignore these symptoms. It is potentially something important, like, for example, an aspirated foreign body in the trachea. And that's why listening to you would have been so useful. And I know the ENT knows how to use a stethoscope because they went through a residency, but I'm not sure they did. Okay, let's go back to our stories. As I said, it's Thanksgiving Eve, and I have a few nice Thanksgiving Eve science stories to tell you about. Also gets us into an interesting discussion of physiology just before we're about to eat the biggest mixed component meal of the year. And that Thanksgiving feast, it's going to have some vegetables, I hope, but it's also going to have a lot of meat. It's going to have a lot of carbohydrate stuffing, potatoes. It's going to have a couple of wonderful desserts, probably. I remember Thanksgiving with my mom. It was always, we have to make these candied sweet potatoes or candied yams. That was just, it was not Thanksgiving without candied yams. And that's probably one of the dishes on your menu as well for many of you. So here's the problem. When you eat a lot of food, you get very full. And interesting things happen physiologically. So let's start with normal data and describe a hormone called LCN2. So you see, in a normal person who doesn't have any health issues and who is not very overweight or very obese, what happens when they eat is that they release insulin. The insulin levels increase, and this signals something called lipogenesis in the liver. And so what happens is the calories, the glucose, are absorbed into the liver, and the liver makes long-chain fatty acids and then triglycerides with them. In other words, the liver makes fat. And you can look into, if you wanted to draw your blood, or if you happen to have blood drawing supplies at home, one of your family members' blood after Thanksgiving, and were able to let it sit, what you would see is a white layer that would form under the red blood cells. And this is a layer of triglycerides, which is why they'll often have you fast before a certain blood test, because the triglycerides get in the way. But they're normal. They're basically fat on the way to being processed. And so as the liver makes fat, it goes to the fat storage areas, and the liver itself is a fat storage area. About the time that the insulin is released, another clock starts ticking, and this is the clock for the production of lipocalin 2, which is, we're going to call LCN2 for the rest of this brief discussion. LCN2 is mainly made in your bone marrow, and when you give that to lab rats, or mice rather, if you synthesize and give it to them, it reduces their food intake and prevents weight gain, and it doesn't slow down their metabolism. Part of what it does is it acts as a signal to the brain, to a center called the hypothalamus, and tells them to stop eating. You're done. You're full. And so as soon as this starts to be released, the appetite shuts down and you hopefully stop eating. So they wanted to see whether they could give it by injection. They know it works in animals, so they're like, okay, well, let's give it to humans, let's inject them. So they looked at a group of four different studies, first of all looking at studies that had already been done on this. In this situation, people were given a meal after having fasted overnight, and the amount of LCN2 in their blood before and after the meal was studied. What they found was those who were of normal weight, there was an increase in levels after the meal, which coincided with the feeling of, okay, I'm full, I'm done. However, in people who were overweight or had obesity, LCN2 levels actually decreased after the meal. So they called these people non-responders. They didn't show an increase. They tended to have more belly fat, a larger waist circumference, and everything you would expect, increased blood pressure, increased glucose. But if you looked at before and after gastric bypass surgery, and we've seen this before, once you did that gastric bypass surgery, the sensitivity and the reaction was restored. So people got to be non-responders. And I've had a number of patients, I wouldn't say many, who've had gastric bypass surgery who report just never feeling hungry. So this is a new mechanism for regulation. Those of you who follow the news may remember about a decade ago, we thought we'd found the answer. It was called leptin. And you may remember some pictures of some very fat mice that had been generated to be leptin receptor deficient. So they didn't produce leptin, the leptin couldn't do its work. So they just kept eating. Well, to figure out if you could inject this stuff and get it into the brain, they injected monkeys, and they got a 28% decrease in food intake. So after 1 week of treatment, all of the animals had a declining rate. This was a placebo trial. So now we know that this can be injected. I'm wondering if this hormone might be the basis for future therapy, because it doesn't seem to have that many downsides. And maybe rather than becoming diabetic, we might switch off hunger in people who are having difficulty controlling their weight gain and their food intake by giving them this lipocalcin. I wanted to have some conclusions. I'm going to go to my second gut hormone story before I give you some advice for tomorrow. But it's good to have the scientific background. I find if you understand why something's going to benefit you, you're way more likely to do it. So let's go to this other study looking at gut hormones and how they play an important role in regulating fat production in the body. I already alluded to this, that there's a hormone that is controlling appetite. Now we're going to talk about a different hormone that is delayed a few hours after eating, and it regulates the liver and stops the process of lipogenesis. So after eating, when the pancreas produces insulin, the liver, as I said, starts to convert foods into fat for storage. And then as the glucose levels drop, as you finish digesting that meal, the insulin turns off and a second hormone is released. This hormone in mice is called FGF-15, and in humans it's called FGF-19. And, you know, they've really got to get more original on these names. But it turns off the fat-producing genes in the liver. So it takes a little while for that to happen, but these molecules actually reach the nucleus of the cell and inhibit gene expression of the genes that are firing up the lipogenesis, the fat production. It's really a circuit breaker for insulin. And think about this. If you eat some cookies, the body releases insulin that promotes the liver to store those calories as fat. But what if that didn't turn off? What if the liver kept making fat? Then it accumulates in the liver. It has nowhere else to go. And this may be how fat non-alcoholic liver disease, NASH syndrome, is formulated. The researchers looked for this pathway, and they saw that it was dysregulated. So if these genes are not activated to produce the gene inhibitor in the humans, FGF-19, the fat's going to accumulate in the liver. I have treated many people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease with simply a paleo diet. So I have several conclusions based on this research. And first of all, after you finish your Thanksgiving feast, first of all, eat slowly and put a little bit of everything on your plate, and then wait, set a timer and wait 5 minutes before you take any seconds. I guarantee it'll make a difference in that, oh my God, I can't believe I ate the whole thing feeling. The other thing is that if you use your muscles after eating, your muscles are going to soak up a lot of that glucose and burn it as fuel. So you're not going to make as much fat out of it. So get up and take a walk. My next bit of advice is go heavy on the protein and light on the carbs. Sure, a spoon of stuffing. Sure, one slice of candied yam. But eat more meat and limit the carbs. And the third bit of advice is delay dessert. Delay dessert a long time, like a couple of hours, and you'll find that you'll eat a lot less of it, and it will probably be more satisfying, and you won't mess up your digestion. So these are just some helpful hints for Thanksgiving that I hope you will consider following. I have this email sent today from Jessica. So this is a cold email. Dear Dr. Dawn, birth control, bleeding, and LEAP. My cousin in her early 30s began Lorina birth control. At the end of her most recent pack, she skipped the placebos and continued straight to the active pills in order to skip her period. She is now on day 28 of her period without a break. She reports moderate to heavy bleeding. Color is red, dark red. For the first 3 weeks on active pills, she experienced no clotting. However, in the last week of placebo, she began having heavier bleeding with clots. Her doctor called this event breakthrough bleeding, which should be followed by withdrawal bleeding. The doctor said the bleeding would stop after starting the new pack. She started the new pack and continued to bleed. How would she recommend she proceed? And are there any therapies she can do now to stop the bleeding and to get back to the regular cycle? Yes, there are. There are several. Any recommendations on supplements to support her during this prolonged cycle? Now, I want to, again, Jessica, tell you that this is a situation where she unbalanced the signaling. And this is not an uncommon problem with birth control pills. Most of the time with the newer pills, you can get away with continuing to take it to skip a period, but every now and then it backfires spectacularly, and this is one of the situation. Here's the next bit. I'm not sure if this is related, but her most recent pap smear came back positive, and she's scheduled for a biopsy. Any information you have on whether this would be related or it's coincidental would be appreciated. She had one LEAP procedure in the past with negative pap smears between then and the most recent positive. She has been on birth control, but there's been a large lapse in time. So let's talk about some of the possibilities. She could have a fibroid that has formed over the last 5 to 7 years when she was off the pill. Birth control pills don't prevent the formation of fibroids. And the area, the fibroid forms in the uterus muscle wall, but the lining can get stretched over it, and it can cause the lining to function inappropriately. The second thing is that the balance of estrogen and progesterone in the pill that she's taking may be way, way off. And in that case, if there's not enough progesterone, she may have ended up giving herself too much lining to be dealt with, and so now she's in a situation of raw tissue. So sounds from what you said that she's 3 or 4 weeks out. I'm going to make a suggestion based on how I would typically manage this situation in pre-COVID times. First of all, I want to say that I do not think that you can assume that this is related to cervical cancer, which is somehow formed in the interval. That would be very unlikely, not impossible. So, of course, she does need to follow up on that. I will kind of stand by saying that things have gotten dysregulated, and now what's happening is that she's not got mature lining. She's got lining that is immature, and she's essentially pulling off the scab. It's like a scab that keeps getting broken, and you're bleeding from under the scab. Typically, I would treat this with high doses of progesterone, and I generally will use synthetic progesterone because it's hard to get high enough levels of natural progesterone. But if we were going to use natural progesterone, it would be doses of like 200 milligrams of Prometrium, which is the prescription drug. She'd have to get that prescribed by her GYN. And the idea here is that you're going to try to mature the lining and stop the growth process. And that will work most of the time, and it's less aggressive than the other treatment. And the other treatment is to give a massive dose of estrogen to flood the receptors, which then turn off the estrogen process. And I learned that 30 years ago, and I haven't seen that done very often since, because it does create a big risk of blood clots when you do it. And of course, no one really wants to take a risk on blood clots. She certainly needs an ultrasound, and the ultrasound will give us a lot of information. It'll tell us if there's fibroids, and it will tell us the thickness of the lining. You say you're seeing clots, and if they are true clots, that's not normal and would certainly indicate that some form of hormone therapy should be tried. The ultimate treatment for this is a DNC, which is very aggressive, and we need to, you know, birth control pills aren't perfect, so hopefully somewhere along the way, someone has actually checked a pregnancy test and made sure that she doesn't have a molar pregnancy, although she'd probably be nauseated if she did have that. So I know that was a lot. It's a complex topic, and I want to emphasize the importance of working closely with your GYN and finding someone who will actually examine you and get that ultrasound. Super, super important here. So I have a lot of interesting short reports. I'll tell you, in reference to the hyperbaric oxygen study, there's a thing called long COVID. You've probably heard of it. In South Korea, this is a study published recently by the South Koreans that said that they had 965 recovered patients, and 91% of them reported at least one persistent side effect. A lot had persistent tiredness. A lot found it hard to concentrate. It also kind of kept coming and going, so just when you thought you were well. I'm really wondering about mitochondrial function in these individuals. And if there's anybody out there who has long COVID and wants to come see me in the office, I want to check and make sure that your mitochondria are functioning properly, because this is really sounding a lot like chronic fatigue syndrome. And the linchpin of chronic fatigue syndrome is sick mitochondria. That's why so many people with so many different diseases manifest in the same way. I'd also love to see whether or not hyperbaric oxygen would work for long COVID, particularly the mental aspects of long COVID. People are acting like they have nerve damage. Hyperbaric oxygen has been shown to improve recovery from stroke, even when given more than a year out from the stroke. But certainly, if you can get to one of those devices early, it's great. Problem? Medicare doesn't cover hyperbaric oxygen for stroke. That would be nice, but alas, no luck there. However, I think you would find it interesting. And in a related COVID-19 story, researchers at Yale University think they may have figured out why children do so much better with COVID-19. And I find this one really fascinating. It relates to upregulation. Now, anyone who's raised a kid knows that when they get something, they run these high fevers. I mean, you get a cold, you won't break a sweat, but your 3-year-old gets a cold and they're spiking 102 and you're, you know, putting cold washcloths on the back of their neck to try to cool them down. This is typical of a very strong innate immune response. And it makes sense, because when you're a child, your immune system is naive. It hasn't experienced anything to develop antibodies to. Once you get past 3 months, any antibodies you got from breastfeeding have really dwindled. You have a few maybe, but it's still, you're going to get big sick and big cytokines. So that innate immune response with the natural killer cells and all of the IL-10 and all those other things that are part of the cytokine storm are going to be big and bad. But as we become older, our immune system gets some experience under its belt. And so we switch to the acquired or the adaptive immune system rather than this sort of blanket defensive action. So they looked at this Yale study, they looked at the immune responses of hospitalized patients, 60 adults and 25 children, and also adults under 24. And the children had higher levels of two immune molecules, which are known to be part of the innate immune response. So they essentially had higher innate immunity. And two of those in the study died. This was a hospitalized cohort, so they were very sick. But children have an earlier innate immune response, which makes it look like a cold and probably protects them from progressing to severe pulmonary disease. Because when you have that strong innate immune response, you also get the counter regulatory response. So you get the growth of, like I said, for everything, there's an equal and opposite reaction in biology. So if you get a big initial innate response, you're going to turn off the stuff. You're going to turn on the stuff that turns off the stuff that causes the cytokine storm and leads to the pulmonary problems. So really super kind of interesting patterns that were emerging. We're learning an awful lot about the immune system. And I have one thing here. I had talked about hyperbaric oxygen, and maybe this would work for the COVID brain fog. They did some testing. This was 84,000 people who had recovered from COVID. This was recently reported in the London Times. I don't have the reference for the study, but it came out of Imperial College London. Basically, the sicker you were, especially those who required a ventilator, they had a high drop-off in brain function, equivalent on the average in people who had severe COVID-19 to 8.5 points in IQ. And aging the brain on those parameters like those telomeres and those senescent cells, a 10-year aging of the brain, cognitive tests basically, and blood tests showing that that brain fog is real and it's not prospective, which means we don't have studies of their brain function before, so it could be a fluke. With 84,000 people, you can often get a fluky thing that isn't really meaningful with any individual, but it's certainly worth investigating further. And speaking of investigating further, it's time for me to say goodnight and go investigate some supper. So this is Dr. Dawn wishing you a safe, healthy, happy, and fit Thanksgiving. Remember, Paleo Thanksgiving. Turkey's a great paleo food. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.